You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's Monday, January 25th, and you're tuned into the Cleveland Baseball Talk Podcast. I'm Joe Noga, joined by Paul Hoynes, our Tribe beat writer. Hoynesy, it was an interesting weekend in the world of baseball. The passing of basically a legend in Hank Aaron on Friday sort of, opened the weekend and, brought up all sorts of memories of, his chase for Babe Ruth's home run record, but also just what an incredible, just icon and figure he was, not just to the baseball world, but also, really to the Black community and to everyone in the United States who just took something away from what Hank Aaron meant to, baseball and really the United States as a whole. What were your feelings when you heard and you learned that Hank Aaron had passed on Friday?
Yeah, Joe. First of all, saying, God, I mean, what a terrible run, we've seen with MLB Hall of Famers, since the start of last year. I think there's 10 or 11 guys have died, and not just, run-of-the-mill Hall of Famers, if you can call them that, but, like Mount Rushmore Hall of Famers, Hank Aaron, Bob Gibson, Lou Brock, Joe Morgan, Whitey Ford, Al Kaline, Tommy Lasorda, Don Sutton, guys like that.
Tom Seaver.
Yeah. Just, the list goes on and on and on. And just, it's really devastating, to baseball, to the fans and to the Hall of Fame. But with Aaron, I think, this is a guy that really was chasing, America's, favorite ball player in Babe Ruth, and got death threats and finally passed him, with the home run record that no one thought could be broken when he hit the 715th home run. And just a guy that, Joe, I never really looked into his career. I mean, I looked at it, but I mean, you just study that career and just how consistent this guy was as a player. And what, 20 straight seasons with 20 or more homers. He had 15 seasons with 30 or more homers, never hit really 47, more than 47 homers in a season, but he stole bases. He was a 30-30 guy and a 25-time All-Star. I mean, it just kind of it's blows you away in over like 23 years, and it's just a 23-year career. So, geez, and to do that in the last big leaguer that had played in started in the Negro Leagues, started his career there. So. Just a great career, a great guy, and he did it under really, really tough conditions.
Right. He went on after his career to really sort of have to be like that ambassador that baseball needed to sort of bridge generations and make sure that You know, just like Jackie Robinson, he wanted to make sure that there were more black players getting involved in the game and promoted their causes as well. I remember he was, when the Indians dedicated the Frank Robinson statue, he was at the ballpark on Heritage Plaza. Frank Robinson, who also passed away last year around this time, the statue that's there as the first black manager in baseball, and Hank Aaron was there to mark the occasion, and just just such a beloved figure. It's spoken so glowingly by, you know, the other writers around the league and those who followed, especially in Atlanta, where you know, he was from Alabama, but Atlanta was sort of his adopted home in that regard. Just one of those luminary figures that I still can't get over. He's number one in RBIs. He's got over 1,600 RBIs. You know, that's another mark that might never be broken.
Over RBIs and total bases. And he's still, I mean, he retired like in 75, 76. You know, Joe, I saw him hit his first American League home run. He was finishing his career with the Brewers. And I think it was like 75, maybe, or 76. Hit it off Gaylord Perry at the stadium. Yeah. So, I remember that. And, that's pretty cool. And, you know, this is a guy that, Joe, the image that sticks out to me, you know, Aaron, while he was chasing Ruth, was, you know, getting death threats and had boxes of hate mail. And he kept all that, you know, and to motivate him, he kept all that mail years after he still had it. And when he finally hit 715 and he's going around the bases, you know, two white kids jump on the field and run around the bases with them to celebrate. And I was just thinking of that, you know, just, this is a black guy, a black man that had been, you know, racial, I mean, just followed with all this hate and vile just because of the color of his skin. And, kind of the first two people to greet him were these two white kids who were just having a heck of a time running around the field. And it just stuck with me with that image. And, I wonder, you know, what the rest of the country or the rest of the world thought about that.
It was probably pretty scary for him if he's out there.
Yeah, it looked like it scared him.
Well, you think about all the threats that were coming true for him. In that moment after he hit second base and those two guys caught up with him, you know, he probably thought, oh, wow, they really meant it when they said they were going to get me if I passed them. I mean, think about it, how terrifying that had to be for him. But you know, it all worked out. That's not the image for me when I see that video is, oh man, I'm glad he didn't turn around and like haul off and punch one of those guys, because that would have sort of ruined the moment. So we, asked our subtext subscribers, who sometimes, tend to skew, maybe on the little bit, more veteran side, I guess, if we can say that. We asked our subtext subscribers in Indian subtext. You can subscribe by going to cleveland.com/subtext or joinsubtext.com/Cleveland Indians. And it's $3.99 a month. Great opportunity to get insight and information from Hoynesy and myself, but also to share your opinions on topics about the Indians or about baseball in general. We asked you guys to give us your impressions of Hank Aaron and what you remember about his chase for 715 way back in 1974, back before I was born. I think at the time my parents were about 13 days away from getting married. So I wasn't even a twinkle yet at the time. But here are some of your responses. Patrick in Garfield Heights writes that he was 15 years old doing homework and had the TV on to watch. He didn't realize he'd be watching history or one of the greatest ever when Al Downing served up that home run on, I believe it was April 8th of 1974. This writer from the 614 area code says, I was a little guy at the time, but like you, I've seen the highlights many times. So like you were saying, that video of Aaron rounding second base and getting greeted by those two guys down in Atlanta who ran with him around the bases briefly. That's one of those indelible video memories that we all see the highlights played over and over again. Here's another writer. He says, I remember it well. I was in Pittsburgh sitting in Taylor's Pub in Shadyside, and that was a tough place for Cleveland fans. My boss's last name was Downing, so needless to say, I had some fun with my boss the next day. So that's an interesting take there.
That's good.
By a guy. All right. From the 419 area code, he writes, it was a nationally televised game that night, so I was in front of our TV. My favorite memory is the scrum for the baseball in the Braves bullpen. Tom House, a relief pitcher, came up with the ball and brought it in and presented it to Hank. House went on to be a noted pitching coach and a baseball movie consultant, even a football quarterback's mechanics coach for Tom Brady. So that's interesting.
Tom House, when he was a pitching coach for Texas, mm-hmm. he was a pitching coach for a bunch of teams. He's the first guy that had pitchers throwing footballs to each other. Mm-hmm. If you ever see that, you know, they to get the, he said the motion kind of replicated that of a pitcher. He got,
right.
And so, you know, you used to see, you don't see it so much anymore, but a lot of guys, you would see pitchers out there throwing footballs around.
Okay. A couple more here. I actually from the same guy in the Toledo area code. I also remember the previous late summer, Hank didn't quite make the record in 1973. He reached 713. So the anticipation during the off season was huge. The 1974 season started in Cincinnati against the Braves, and many wanted Hank to sit out the opening series so he could tie and break the record in Atlanta. He tied it with 714 in Cincinnati and then moved on to Atlanta to break it. So that's interesting that there were calls for Hank Aaron to sit out the first series in Cincinnati so that he didn't break the record too quickly.
Yeah. They were looking for a sellout down in Atlanta. They wanted to sell some tickets to that one.
Well, if he would have hit 715 in Cincinnati, you know, the gate sales in Atlanta probably wouldn't have been all that, robust the following series. This guy writes that he remembers the song Move Over, Babe, Here Comes Henry, the lyrics by Ernie Harwell, the music written by my Tigers pitcher, Bill Slayback. So there, and he provided a YouTube link, but I guess that doesn't exactly translate right here on our podcast. Finally, here's a Hank story from Bud in Arizona. He says, I was living in Houston during the mid-80s and did a power station repair job at Phillips Petro and became friends with the maintenance superintendent, and we talked baseball during the job. He had great stories to tell about Hank during the 1960s and early 70s when the Braves played the Colt 45s. Hank wasn't allowed to stay at the team hotel, so he stayed with my friend whenever the Braves were in town. He told me Hank was the kindest and most humble man he ever met. He never heard Hank complain about the horrible racial injustices and never took advantage of his baseball fame. When Hank was in town, he was just Hank the man and not Hammer and Hank the baseball icon. If ever there was a sports model, it was Hank. Rest in peace, Hank. The world was a better place when you were in it. So really touching from Bud, who knew a guy who used to have to board Hank Aaron when he came into town because he wasn't allowed to stay with his teammates. That to me in this day and age just seems the craziest thing. But again, you're talking about a guy who was probably one of the best and most well-rounded hitters in the history of the game.
Yeah. I mean, Joe, I mean, you take away 755 home runs, he still had over 3,000 hits, you know, so he still would have gotten a Hall of Fame. And he was a huge Browns fan, Joe. He was, I guess, you know, when I covered the Browns a long time ago, I remember a couple times, you know, you would look around and there was Hank Aaron at practice. Mm-hmm. You know why? Yeah. And you were sitting there thinking, what is that really Hank? You know, is that really Hank Aaron? And he said, you know, he told the reporters that, you know, sometimes he disguised himself and sit in the dog pound. And, you know, Bobby DiBiasio, who's still working for the Indians, told me that every Friday during the football season, he'd get a call from Aaron and he'd want updates on the Browns. You know, so he saved all the papers from the week and would tell him who's healthy and who's hot, who's not. And it's weird like that. And the day he broke Babe's record, you know, Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner, mm-hmm. and Bowie was in Cleveland giving an address, giving an address to the Wahoo Club because he'd made a commitment to the Wahoo Club.
So and couldn't be
instead of being in Atlanta to watch history.
Very interesting. Bobby DiBiasio, Browns insider. I didn't know that that was one of Bobby D's titles. I think we'll have to bust his chops the next time we're able to see him in person at the ballpark to talk about that. But very interesting to note that Bobby D and Hank Aaron used to talk Browns in the offseason. Wow.
Yeah, Bobby said every Friday you get two calls in the morning, one from Hal Leibowitz, you know, the PD sports editor for his mm-hmm. Sunday notes, and the next one from Hammer and Hank.
Crazy. That's really interesting. All right. Moving on from one Hall of Famer legend to potentially others. The vote for this year's Hall of Fame is coming up. The results are set to be released tomorrow evening, 6 o'clock on Major League Baseball Network, Tuesday here. Right now, tracking the top vote getters, it looks like as of right now, Curt Schilling is a strong possibility to be named and on 3/4 of the ballots. Get that 75% and get in. Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens tracking just below the necessary 75%. So they will likely not be in. And Omar Vizquel looking like, the guy who had been up in the 50% range, looks like he's dropped off slightly. What's the latest that you're hearing in regards to that?
Yeah, Omar was, at 52.6% last year, at the end of last year's balloting. I thought he was in a great, like we've talked before, Joe, I thought he was in a great spot to really move up maybe 60, 65% this year. There wasn't the 2021 class didn't include a can't miss guy or a first ballot guy. And I thought the path was open for him. And then the domestic violence story broke with the Athletic. And I think that's really, really hurt him. And, I think the last time, the people that keep track of the voting, Ryan Thibodeau, he's tracking the votes that have been made public. And he has them at 40%. Now, when the votes get announced, those tend to, it might jump a little bit, but that's a significant drop. And, I think a lot of voters voted before this story came out. So the repercussions of this story, are going to really influence Omar, not this year, but next year as well, as more details come out.
Yeah. You could maybe see an even greater drop there. There's a possibility. And that's a character issue, and that's not an on-field, discussion. Omar is very worthy. Character issues, those come into play sometimes with these voters, particularly with the steroid era guys and that. But it's interesting to note that Curt Schilling is a guy who, the voting was all done before the end of the year, before December 31st, you had to have your ballots in.
Yeah.
Curt Schilling is a guy who's tracking right now to be in. And that was, voters were at the time looking past his, conservative or right-wing views, the things that he said that have sort of put him in a negative light in that regard. But after the Capitol uprising on January 6th, he came out and supported some of the insurrectionists and what they did. And we've now got stories of at least one or two guys who voted for Schilling in this last cycle who have inquired as to whether or not they can rescind their vote and take it back. So Kurt Schilling comes out. He's Mr. Breitbart. He's Mr. Right Wing, you know, Trump supporter, whatever. For a while, it had held him back a little bit. This year, it looks like he's going to get in. And now he comes out and supports violent insurrectionists. Rightfully or wrongfully, they're going to ask if they can take their votes back, which they can't. But meanwhile, Omar's over there getting, you know, losing his support as well. There's just no consistency on character issues among the Hall of Fame voters. Either you've got Hall of Fame character or you don't.
There is a character clause in the voting. I mean, you're supposed to take that into account. I think. What am I saying here? I might be wrong on that.
I believe there's a morals clause somewhere in there where it says that, you know, you're supposed to take into account whether this is a Hall of Fame worthy person, not just ball player.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Schilling to me almost seems like he doesn't want to get in. I mean, this is a guy at 70% of the vote, Joe, last year. I mean, only one other player, I think, has not got elected, you know, in the history of the Hall of Fame when he's reached a 70% threshold. And this guy seems to, I mean, I don't know what his point is. You know, I really don't. Or is he like thumbing his nose at the writers and saying, you know, I can say anything you want, and if you don't elect me, you know, it's on you. You know, I mean, it's such a weird thing. And I've read a bunch of stories where guys that had voted for him in the past were no longer voting for him. But I don't know. It's a tough situation, and I don't get it. I'm not sure what this guy is angry about.
If you stripped away all the off-field stuff away from baseball and just looked at his baseball career and what he did and what the games he won and the times he pitched, Kurt Schilling is on his face a Hall of Famer. I don't think there's a lot you can argue about that if you go by just the numbers. But like you said, all he had to do was keep his mouth shut between this time last year and now, and he would sail in. There would be no question about any of that other stuff, but he continues to push and he continues to make his Hall of Fame candidacy more about his character than about his play. And I don't understand how anybody can vote for someone who now has since the ballot, if he had come out and said any of this, or if January 6th had happened, you know, before the ballots were due, I think that would have really hurt him in a lot of ways, because just like the way, you know, people in Congress shouldn't be supported for trying to take down the election, I don't think, you know, Kurt Schilling should be elected in regards to his support of those insurrectionists. That's just not something I see as happening. He's on the ballot again. Was this his last year of eligibility?
No, he's got one more year left. This is Schilling's, let's see. This was Schilling's ninth year, so he's on one more.
If he somehow doesn't make it this year, I don't see how he gets the support in his final year.
Yeah, a lot of people say no one will get elected to this hall.
Yeah.
You know, that this Hall of Fame class, and you know, that could be right. I'd hate to see it. But we've got the overlap from last year because there was no ceremonies last year, but. We've had like the last 10, 12 years, we've had like a ton of big,
huge classes,
huge classes get in, and, quality players get in too.
Bonds and Clemens still have this year and next year eligibility.
Yeah. Bonds, Clemens, Schilling and Sosa are in their ninth year. This is their ninth year. So they've got one more year to go.
Very interesting. All right, moving on.
Manny's in his fifth year, so he's got five more to go.
But yeah, I don't know about Manny.
Manny is going to stay at about 30-35%, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That's my prediction.
All right, moving on. We did find out Former Indians closer Brad Hand agreed to terms with the Washington Nationals on a one-year contract. 1 year, $10.5 million, when he was set with an option for the Indians at $10 million with a $1 million buyout. But the Indians cut him loose, didn't pick up the option. So he really made an extra $500,000 by becoming a free agent and signing with the Nationals?
Yeah, I just, this is such a weird thing. I mean, A, is that really the market for Brad Hand, who was 16 for 16 and, you know, for saves, led the big leagues in saves, games, led the American League in games finished. And, you know, obviously, you know, there probably is some concern because his fastball velocity has dropped, but he was, you know, slider was still, he's still striking people out. So maybe, you know, maybe people weren't looking at him as a closer. But the weird thing is, Joe, if you knew what you do now, back when they didn't pick up his option, the Indians, wouldn't you be tempted to pick up his option and maybe try to trade him? And maybe you could have got something. I don't know what you could have got in return, but maybe they were scared of the market. There just wasn't a market, and they just didn't think they'd get a good return for him.
Yeah, and then you've got $10 million, Brad Hand, yeah, sitting there as your highest paid player. As it turns out, it only cost him $1 million in the buyout for that option.
And you got Karen Check.
You've got Karen Check. I what you said is probably true. I think maybe a lot of teams weren't looking at him as a closer, maybe as an eighth inning guy, because he's effective against righties. He can get both sides of the plate out. He really does slot as more of an eighth inning guy now, to in my mind. Also, he lives, I believe, in Jupiter, Florida. And that's right around where the Nationals train. Like, he's in their backyard in terms of spring training. So that's nice for him. I don't know if that was a big reason why he signed there, but you know, it just be interesting to see. He's in the National League East. He's going to be facing some of the best in baseball. That National League East is the most competitive division right now on paper that baseball has heading into the season. Probably along with the National League West. Speaking of divisions getting more competitive, the rich get richer as the Yankees trade for Jameson Taillon from the Pirates. The Pirates right now are basically every team's AAA affiliate, as they've traded away Joe Musgrove. They've now traded away Jameson Taillon, who had an advocate in the Yankees clubhouse in terms of Gerrit Cole, a former teammate, who said, hey, if you're going to bet on somebody, bet on Jameson coming back from his second elbow surgery. So Aaron Boone and the Yankees rolled the dice. They traded four prospects to get Taillon. Now the Yankees rotation looks like you've got Cole, Severino, Kluber, Taillon in the mix, Jordan Montgomery. They're shaping into a decent enough starting rotation.
Yeah, and at Devi Cruz, and they brought a couple guys in, you know, on minor league deals. Shaquin is in there. You know, it's going to be interesting because they lost so many guys, Joe. Do they, you know, who'd they lose?
Paxton.
Tanaka, yeah. So, you know, and you know, it's going to be interesting to see how that rotation comes together. For sure, definitely. And the Pirates have made all these trades. They traded Josh Bell to Washington, and they've got like 14 prospects for all this year. So I guess Ben Cherington, you know, they're going to have a lot of players to sort through. Derek Shelton and Ben Cherington are going to have a lot of players to sort through in spring training. And the rebuild has begun in serious nature in Steel City.
Is it possible to tear things down past the studs? That's what, that's what they're doing in Pittsburgh. Our friend Anthony Castrovince from MLB.com tweeted something funny. He said, I don't know who's going to win the NL East this year, because there's a lot of teams that are in it. I don't know who's going to win the NL East this year, but I know who's not going to win the NL East. I'm sorry, the NL Central. I see. I'm NL sorry. Central. Is the NL? It's like, I know who's going to win the, I don't know who's going to win the NL Central, but I know who's not. And it was the Pittsburgh Pirates. Boy, I screwed that up, didn't I? All right. Speaking of young pitching prospects, we did get a chance on Friday to talk to Tristan McKenzie from the Indians. Boy, I'll tell you what, for 23 years old, Tristan McKenzie is polished and a pro at doing press. He is, he speaks in perfect quotes and has well thought out responses. It's going to be a joy over the next 4 or 5 years to cover Tristan McKenzie. And just as long as his attitude stays as positive as he is, he was really a pleasure to talk to on Friday and just get his thoughts on a lot of things. He didn't say much. He didn't reveal much, but it was still interesting to talk to him and a lot of fun. I think the biggest thing that we took away from McKenzie's time talking to us there was he wants to go to that next level. He wants to sort of pick everybody's brains. And now that he's gotten a taste and he's seen what, you know, it's like day to day in the big leagues, he's got that blueprint and that path. And he's just going to sit there with a notebook and study everybody and take something away from Shane Bieber. Corey Kluber, geez. Take something away from Shane Bieber. Learn from Zach Plesac and Aaron Civale, guys that he talks to every day. Just a really interesting sort of 10, 15-minute conversation with Tristan McKenzie. What did you take away from that?
Yeah, I agree, Joe. His answers – you know, he always says something, but he's kind of short and sweet. He's short and concise. You know, he's not going to sit there and ramble and get himself into trouble, which is a good thing. You've been telling, I don't know if the Indians have a media coach or what, but they've made an impression on him. And, you know, I like the fact that he said, I think somebody asked him, did you go on vacation after the season? He goes, no, he just went home, you know, and spent time at home in Florida. And as opposed to last winter, where he was in Goodyear the whole winter rehabbing,
go ahead. You're gonna get to it.
No, go on.
He said his vacation was staying home and eating his mother's cooking.
Yeah, that's what. So hopefully he gained a few pounds. Yeah. That's all. But I really liked what he said about Hank Aaron. You know, he was asked about that, and he's a 23-year-old kid. I mean, he was born, I think, maybe over 20 years after Hank's last season in the big leagues, but he knew about him. He said just the right things. You could tell this kid is, he's paying attention. He's got, and he just said, you know, we've lost one of, you know, the black pillars of baseball, or one of the pillars of baseball. You know, when you talk about Hank Aaron, you say home run king, and just kind of just great answers and a thoughtful kid. You could tell he's just not saying the first thing that comes to his mind.
Right. Now, he was asked about what it was like coming home and spending the off season with his younger brother, who is an infielder at Vanderbilt. And after now he's made it to the big leagues. He's realized that dream. And, you know, he was asked whether he's walking around, you know, sort of puffing out his chest big time and his brother, in front of the family when you're spending time at home. And he said, this is it. It's everything that we dreamed it would be. And when he's talking to his brother and saying, you know, what you pictured it was going to be, that's what it's like. He said it was, he had a real appreciation for even just the 8 games he appeared in and, you know, the month and a half that he spent in the big leagues this past season. So again, yeah, everything was weird. No debut in front of, you know, a crowd full of people for him. No big league debut that was sort of taken away from him by the virus. But you know, the experience I think is going to help him. And I guess he still qualifies as a rookie this upcoming season. If he spends a year on the roster.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
He would be eligible for, you know, rookie of the year consideration if this is his upcoming season will be his rookie year. So one to watch for, definitely for, and I don't think Karinchak would qualify as a rookie.
No, year. I think he's probably exceeded. Yeah. I like the fact, Joe, that Tristan was calling Bieber and texting Plesac and Savali and exchanging notes and just talking to them, talking to your teammates. I'm sure kind of picking their brain, or just like he texted Plesac to wish him happy birthday. You know, that's it shows you, you know, that he's thinking, he's learning, and you know, he's got a good head on his shoulders.
All right. Well, one thing that Tristan McKenzie didn't know, or didn't really have the answers to, was when he's going to report to spring training, or when the club expects him to sort of get things underway. We're still unsure. I think Major League Baseball hasn't made any sort of announcements or anything. With the way that the coronavirus is still sort of raging across the country, and the rollout of the vaccine being slow as it is, what do you think the chances are that we're going to start spring training on time and get everything going on time?
You know, that's a great question, Joe. You know, I know, Commissioner Rob Manfred, Paul Dolan, and Terry Francona talked to the Indians corporate sponsors late last week. And Manfred's message was, you know, we intend to open the season on time and spring training on time. You know, the regular season opens April 1st. Spring training is scheduled to open around February 17th. But I've also heard, you know, from like you said, with Tristan McKenzie, we also talked to Andres Jimenez and Ahmed Rosario last week, the two infielders the Indians received from the Mets in the Lindor Carrasco deal. And they didn't know when they were reporting to spring training. I mean, that's a date you have circled on your calendar. You know, as soon as, like 2 weeks after the end of the previous season. I've also heard, you know, they teams still don't know how many players are going to be allowed in the at the complex at the same time, at the spring training complexes at the same time. The roster sizes are still up in the air. The use of a universal DH is still undecided. So there's a lot of balls in the air here right now, Joe. And you know, I would think, you know, somebody's got to kind of drop the hammer here and make a decision pretty soon, because what is it? It's it's January 25th, right?
It's 25th. Hoisey, it's the 25th.
Yeah,
we're getting closer. Breaking news right here. I just got a text saying that we should anticipate a Zoom this week with Indians public relations department, baseball operations department, discussing spring training specifics with reporters. So maybe we're moving at a glacial pace, but maybe there is some light at the end of the tunnel here. We could be looking at some answers pretty soon. So we'll keep an eye on that. We'll keep an eye on how the Hall of Fame voting turns out tomorrow night. We'll be back with you on Wednesday with another edition of the Cleveland Baseball Talk podcast. Hoinsie, we'll see you then.
All right, Joe.